Well, good evening and welcome to the Michigan Writers Series, sponsored by the Library's Computing and Technology Division and Schuler Books and Music. I'm Stephanie Mattson and as Publicity Coordinator for these events, it's my job to remind you that our last Michigan Writers Series event of the semester will be the Student Writers Night, our annual event in 3 weeks. That said, this evening I'm pleased to introduce to you poet and playwright David James. He's published 3 poetry collections, including A Heart Out of This World, Do Not Give Dogs What Is Holy, and I Dance Back. In 2 weeks, David's latest one-act play, The Telepath at Lucky's Bar and Grill, will be produced at the Nantucket Theater in Massachusetts. His other one-act plays include The Aftermath, Finding the Muse, and After Godot, which have all been produced off-Broadway. David earned an MA in creative writing from Central Michigan University, and he holds a doctorate in education from Wayne State. Currently, he is instructor in the English and Speech Department at Oakland Community College. After he concludes his reading, David will open the floor for questions and discussion and then sign books, which he has copies of for sale up here. Now, please help me welcome David James.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's great to be here. I want to thank the Michigan State Library, Peter Berg and Stephanie Mattson, and Mike Rodriguez for inviting me and letting me be part of this series. I'd like to start. I'm going to read a few poems from each book, just so you get a feel for them, and then end with a bunch of new poems. I'd like to start with one. This is a very typical poem that I used to write when I was very young. long time ago, it seems like. And I was afraid generally to write anything that had to do with me personally. And so I wrote about things that were very imaginative. So the first couple of poems are like that, I think. This one is called You Are Made of Glass. You are made of glass windows, fit together at the joints except for your face, which is a mirror. Your husband clearly knew what he was getting when he married you. On those lovely trips when he drove you out to the woods, he said he could see the world through you, your body of grass, trees, the dirt of cornfields. By now, he is used to the cold breasts digging into his chest like icicles. He is even amused by kissing his own reflection in your face. After you take a shower, he likes to rub your skin with a towel, shining the oval stains of water. In bed, you seem to glow for a few seconds after the lights are turned off. Still, you know you are a woman and come to accept certain pain, like those nights when he climbs on top of you, pushing farther and farther, exploding inside like a handful of small pebbles, dotting your back with cracks. Another one that I wrote a long time ago when I was at Western Michigan University as an undergrad. I just liked the title, actually. I think I started writing it because of the title. And I was thinking back to those times when people, like the primitive types, the kind times when people didn't know as much as we know today. It's called Those Lovely Years Before the Invention of Music. So it was long before the invention of musical instruments when people learned about sounds. The earth was a body lying on its back. It was a time when they thought the sun, like the heart of a zebra, was edible. And so they watched it fall into the open throats of trees day after day. And by listening to the intricate noises rising from the stomach of a starving child, they could predict when the next rain would come and how much. They sat up in the darkness to hear the moon jump from star to star. They believed there was an arm inside everyone, a solid fist pounding at the chest to get out. And though today we know better, explain why there is a faint singing that drifts around me even now, as if someone was strumming a bone along the paths in my head, leading old men and women into mourning. Now, in graduate school, I remember doing a paper on medieval dream theory. This is the thing you do when you're in graduate school. You know, these great papers that are kind of meaningless in some way. But as I was doing research for this paper, it was in a Chaucer class, I came across this quote by Hippocrates. And this is for most writers, when you see a certain quote, something somebody says, something you read, it often just screams, write a poem. Okay? This is one that did that to me. It's a poem called The Disease. And the quote by Hippocrates is, sexual intercourse is a mild attack of epilepsy. And it can happen anywhere without the slightest warning. As you wake up, or in the back closet of the office, on the expressway, during lunch, in your childhood years, at the movies. You may be in the middle of a conversation, in the middle of saying the word lettuce, and you'll lose it all, collapsing to the floor or over a table, your body jerking in spasms. I take your clothes off and lie on top of you to keep your arms and legs from hurting themselves. I hold your tongue with my lips so you don't swallow it and choke. Sometimes it takes only a few minutes, and other times we wrestle like this for hours until finally it ends and you stand up, dressing quickly, while I look around, scuffing my feet on the sidewalk or floor as if nothing happened, as if we were normal. And the last one out of a heart out of this world. This is a true story. Of course, everything's true in here. Sorry, I didn't mean to say that. Everything is true that I write about. But I went to a party once and it was a Wayne State medical student who was at this party, and he brought out a heart out of his pocket. Come on in. He brought out a heart and claimed it was his grandmother's, that when she died, he did the autopsy on her. The poem's called Bloodline. He carries it with him, a gnarled brownish heart, his grandmother's. It's in his pocket, a dried leathery muscle cracked in the middle from opening it up at parties, at school, at family reunions, pointing out the arteries, veins, the valves that still click when he fingers them. This is the atrium, this the right ventricle. For 72 years, that heart lived inside his grandmother. Set in blackness, in blood, he knew it as a child when she rocked him against her chest, her heart beating inches away. Now he holds it between his fingers. In quiet times, he sits on the stairway, lightly touching the length of heart. And all these nights, when he lies in bed, pressing it against him, pulsing toward sleep, his own heart is already floating to the hands of others. All right, I'll move to Do Not Give Dogs What Is Holy. This was a whole book of poems. Well, it's a chapbook, but it was written about mostly religious ideas. Often there's a quote, you know, an epigram by a out of the Bible. It starts one of the poems. In fact, the title, Do Not Give Dogs What Is Holy, comes from Matthew, the book, the Gospel of Matthew. When I was driving home, I used to work in Flint, at University of Michigan, Flint. And I was driving home one day after work, and as I went by this one church, it said sermon topic, and it was probation after death. And that's one of those ones where, you know, it's screaming. You got to write about it. So it's called Probation After Death. You never were lucky. It was in the stars, settling in the tea leaves, certainly in your palms, this knack for finding trouble. Flat tires, lost checks, train accidents, premature balding. Even as a kid, you were the one. You were the only one who hit liners through Bladecki's window, the one caught stealing tomatoes out of Mr. Jump's backyard. If the police were going to randomly stop anyone on the road, it'd be you, with wine bottles on the floor, your driver's license expired, 5 parking tickets overdue. But now you've gone and made your biggest mistake. You died, and you end up on probation. Maybe God is waiting to see how well you take to those new wings, or how long you can stay afloat on a cloud. Maybe he needs a tenor for the choir. Probation might just be standard policy for anyone heading up from Flint, Michigan. But one Sunday morning, in a lazy moment, slouched back against the pearly gates, you'll forget where you are and say, God damn it, and you'll be history, waking up in someone's body in a town you never heard of with yet another life sentence. And then I bought this book of questions. It's a big book, and it just has the question, all these questions that you always ask, or you people ask, and it has the answer to all these questions. I'm trying to think of one. The title of this next poem is one of these questions, and I've used a lot of the questions as poem titles and ideas for poems. You know, like, oh, I know one. Can a dog running across trotting across a suspension bridge caused the suspension bridge to fall down? I don't know if I ever had that question myself, but I guess it's an important question. This one is a little different. The question is, does the body weigh the same immediately after death? The old belief states that once dead, the soul escapes and rises into splendor, leaving the body lighter than before, easier to carry out into the back field. For a common sinner, maybe an ounce or two. For a God-fearing woman, 2 or 3 pounds of spirit gone. The children become as light as cloth, lifting up into the arms and faces of fathers who turn a shade of pale not found in nature. In these not modern times, we know better, although some of us still believe in a soul flying out of control toward heaven. The truth lies somewhere inside, where the dead set their luggage down. Their voices are thick and slow, faces like disconnected hands slapping through our brains. For months, for years, forever sometimes, the heaviness in our breathing, this dead weight, gets explained away as age. And my most recent one, little chapbook, I Dance Back. I'll read a couple out of here. There's one from a friend of mine in high school. He's one of these guys who always wanted a girlfriend and could never get a girlfriend, couldn't even get a date. And Actually, he was 42 when he married, and he was 47 when his wife had twins. So he finally got what he wanted, but it took him a long time. But he used to send me letters, and he would go on blind dates. And this, the title of this poem is actually a line from his letter that he wrote to me about one of his blind dates. And in the letter he wrote, "She dances like Mussolini." "Short and stout, her hair unable to fly loose from her head, my blind date marches across the dance floor, arms jerking, her whole body banging into others. With each impact, she salutes and shouts up into the music. This is the last time, I tell myself, the last time. But in minutes, she has everyone in the bar marching in rows, or everyone ordering Chianti. Bodies barge and ram, people scream and kick their legs out in time to the beat. I can't understand a word of the shouting, the guttural grunting phrases. My date winks at me across the length of the floor and then starts this way, dancing like Mussolini. And God knows I'm sick. I dance back." This one, I have my one of my oldest son to thank for this poem. We're sitting around, he was 3 years old. We're sitting around in the living room, and the TV was not on, the radio was not on. I remember I was reading. He was playing with something. And finally he came up to me and said, "Dad, there's just nothing like a dead horse." I said, "You're right, Colin. There's nothing like a dead horse." Where he got it from, I have no idea. But so I wrote a poem called Dead Horses with that epigram, "There's just nothing like a dead horse, Colin." "They are much easier to mount this way. Mother has nothing to fear as Susie heads out to ride the dead horse. In fact, she saves hundreds on grain, hay, veterinarian bills. And yet the horse can still be groomed, combed, brushed, prepared for show, braids and ribbons displayed. The two commands that always work, lay down, play dead. There's just nothing like a dead horse, easy to convert into a coffee table, a bench chair, a conversation piece. So, how long have you had your dead horse? Or, let's go back to my place and I'll show you my dead horse." "A dead horse is quiet, serene, majestic in an odd way, requiring a minimum of care. It's natural enough. Horses die, like everything, but they aren't like everything. So much power, so much pure grace. It seems more of a disgrace to bring the tractor in, drag the body out to some meadow, spend half the day digging. So I pull it in the house, this symbol of young America, a perfect addition to anyone's three-bedroom ranch." And last from this book, I used to have a lot of hair, okay, when I was younger, just so you guys know. I used to have real long hair, actually. But things happen as you get older. And so this poem is for Mike. And what's your name, sir? John, yeah. Particularly for John, Mike, and myself. It's called, it's a letter poem to, it's called Dear Hairline. "Where the hell are you going? You're losing your grip with age, falling up and back over my skull. You seem to take pleasure in undressing my forehead, tossing precious hair down the drain on the bathroom counter, clumps sleeping on my pillow. It won't be long now You'll keep slipping away until you're alive only in photographs and memories. And I'll be a cue ball, glaring into the future, baldly going where bald men have gone before. I'll save money on barbers. I'll buy a convertible. I'll have a great hat collection. I'll let my wife stroke my smooth skin, buff my head with beeswax. The only hairline I'll have in 5 years will be something I can hang out on the clothesline, easy on, easy off. But who cares anyway? Hairlines are for babies and snotty-nosed boys. Real men like us don't have to cover up who we really are, with only our shine and brains to get us through. We accept what God meant for us and head out into the world face first. Okay. I live now on a golf course, actually. I can't belong to the golf course. Can't afford that, but I can look at it, and I have at least one son who sneaks out and plays a few holes. But I think that's what kind of was the impetus for this next poem. Along with writing a lot of poems, religious kinds of poems. The title is God Takes Up Golf. More of a walker, he rarely uses a cart. The golf bag floats in midair following behind him, the right club easing out and into his hands at will. God's swing is picture perfect, though he sometimes tries to put more into it than necessary. Only a few will give him advice, Moses, David, Abraham. They know he doesn't need it, but it helps to pass the time. A small spectator crowd of angels, archangels, and cherubims trail within earshot, singing hymns of green praise. God can't help but think of the front nine as the Old Testament. Through narrow woods and deep valleys, the back nine is the New Testament, wide open and forgiving. The prophets and apostles humor the Almighty as they lay down bet after bet, playing God one-on-one. They never win. They may take a skin every century or so, but it's rare. Only Christ can give the old man a run for his money. It usually ends up in a shootout after 18, sudden death, and you know how that goes. here's a new one. New one I've never read before, so you'll have to take it easy on me, okay? Trying to think of what to say about this. I think as we get older, we realize how much more we're connected to other people and events and times. I guess I say this because even coming here today, I sent little flyers to Lenora and Dennis, and I haven't seen them in years and years, but I still feel connected in some way to them. So I think we place a different value on the time and the experience as we get older. And I think that's what this poem's about. Called The Fine Line. Hung like a sock on the line, a candy wrapper wedged in a rose bush, a penny kicked along the sidewalk. I live at the mercy of others. A woman's smile there turns my heart. A little boy swinging a bat in the yard brings back my green Sparks hat and running bases on North Shore's diamond. The spring day sun stretching through the bare trees reverses time, and I am sitting at the cottage with a cup of coffee, reading Walden, soon to be a father. Each day the world gets thrown in my face, like wind lifting me, sending me tumbling. This old woman walks in and asks a question. That man stares at me too long. The clouds above form into faces. A girl touches my coat sleeve by accident. And so I do what any sane man would do. I fall to my knees and beg for more. I do write a lot of letter poems. That seems to be a fun thing for me to do. Like the Dear Hairline and, I have a bunch of them, Dear Feet and Dear, every part of my body, basically. I won't read them all to you, though. But here's one that I've gotten away from parts of my body, and now I'm writing letters to other concepts. So this is called Dear Future. What would I say if I could to the future? Dear future, you're one step ahead of me at every turn. The shy, silent type, you prefer the back booth, candlelit, out of sight, but within striking distance. For the longest time, I thought you couldn't speak, but the past told me you choose not to. Give me one evening, you and me alone, over beers, and let's be frank. Tell me straight to my face, will I get the promotion, the convertible, the cute little bungalow on the bay? Will I live to kiss my grandchildren's children? Will this knee really have to be replaced? Will I see 80? Will I go before my wife? But you blend into dusk, the night, the city, and I'm left to watch shadows stretch out under a full moon. We'll meet, I'm sure, at least once more at a time of your choosing. But I'm warning you now, be ready to duck. I had a cousin who was 16 years old, and it was a kind of a troubled youth, but she was arguing with her parents while they were driving down a road, and just one of those stupid things, she just impulsively opened the door and jumped out. And it was a very sad event, but it's also one of those kind of events that cause you to wonder and cause you to write about, particularly about what the parents must think. So I wrote a poem called No Amount of Time. For Julianne, 16. How and when you lost yourself doesn't matter now, but the why of what you did will burn in us until the last light goes black for good. As the old folks like to say, you had the world in the palm of your hand. At what point, after you opened the car door, barreling along M19 and jumped out, did your short life flash and tumble through your brain? In those milliseconds before impact at 55 miles per hour, did you wish you had stayed in the back seat and cried instead? Did the cement rise up in slow motion, scraping the flesh clear off your small hands stuck out to break the fall? No amount of space or time can keep you away. Every single day, you assemble your mangled, bleeding body and come home to sit in the brains of your father and mother. But the words you need to say will not be spoken. You simply stare back at them, pleading, shaking, until you can no longer hold your bones in place. Now for something completely different than that. I have a poem here. It's an instructive poem for you. How many people in here do not like country music? Raise your hand. Do not like, okay. Okay, so this poem is for you, okay? Just for you. It's called How to Fall in Love with Country Music. It creeps into your life like fungus, like cold sores, like your old high school girlfriend suddenly appearing at the doorstep, missing half of her teeth, and claiming to be the mother of two of your children. It simply wears on you, the twang of the steel guitar grating against your better judgment. Always the sad voice recreating a life of divorcees and pickup trucks and bar fights and driving the lone road to Omaha. And the more you listen, the easier it is to believe your mother really did run off with the mailman. And you were fired for pissing on the boss's desk. And the woman you love loves your best friend's dad. You don't fall in love with country music. It falls in love with you. Or rather, it breaks down one small section of the brain and you become helpless to the urge to wear a cowboy hat, to learn the Texas two-step, to buy a gun rack. And all along, the music is telling you just how lonely you are. And damn if it's not true. I have a little prose poem here from my, it's for my grandfather, actually. And it's called The Lesson. It's a lesson I've had, I think most of us have to learn at some point. But it's a prose poem as well, in prose form. The Lesson for Leonard Kyle. I didn't know at the time why he told me. It wasn't like him, the grandpa who barked at waitresses, recited poems from grade school in England, raised chickens in his backyard, told bad jokes over and over. Like the time he asked me, at my age, 81, do you know what it's like to make love? It's like trying to stuff a marshmallow into a piggy bank. That's true, too. I can't remember where or how anymore, but Grandpa told me the following story for a reason. He worked for Michigan Consolidated Gas Company for 40 years, the last 20 as management. He'd be called in any time, day and night, for all kinds of emergencies. What's in it for me, he'd ask, knowing full well there was no overtime for managers. Kyle, his boss replied every time, your reward is in heaven. And Grandpa went in every time, missing his children's birthday parties, anniversaries, Thanksgiving dinner, confirmations, known at work as the dependable one, the loyal one. Years later, at his own retirement party, my grandfather told me he strolled over to his former boss and said, so, what's my reward in heaven gonna be? The boss looked up at him square in the eyes, A bale of hay, you jackass. I didn't know at the time what that meant, but I've had to learn. Well, it's spring, right?
Yeah,
spring. We like that. And of course, I have my traditional spring poem. Wouldn't be a spring reading without a spring poem. Called Spring Fever. And I was telling Mike that that's one thing I like about living in Michigan is that every season is so pronounced that, you know, it just gives you new ideas for poems every time. Every year I write spring poems. Every year I write winter poems. Every year I write fall poems. Summer, I don't write as much, I guess. Spring Fever. It is my 48th spring in this country of doom. The first six I don't recall. After that, each spring, all 42 of them blend together into one messy spring with fat robins, steady rainfall, the tulips first to bloom on the north side of the house. The grass sucks all the green out of the air. The trees grow light beards made of small buds, while birds clamor at the feeder for more. The wind tastes like a cold beer sent over to me from Old Man Winter, who sits at the bar winking, downing jello shots like there's no tomorrow. And then the world crawls out of its hole, squinting, swearing. Picking up a clump of mud, it marks 48 on my forehead. And I stand out here, looking up into the heavens, waiting for the storm to come and wash me clean, God willing, for another year. Well, how many people in here have seen the passion of Jesus Christ? I haven't seen it yet, so I don't know. But this poem is for Jesus Christ. It's called A Hard Act. Yours is a hard act to follow. You gave and gave until it killed you. So far, I am unable to bring the dead back to life. I can't turn water into wine, no matter how hard I try. The seven loaves, when served, are gone, eaten, lodged safely in digestive tracts. Hell, it's a miracle for me to get to work on time. So to walk in your path, to follow your lead, may require a lowering of standards. Let's say I stop swearing in front of the kids and cut back on the beer on weekends. I start recycling old newspapers. Let's say I make a concerted effort not to kill my asshole neighbor. Maybe I could smile more and use a blinker when turning. This is all a start, at least. Even you took 30 years before you came into your own, found the rhythm and timing, and you had help from above. I'm left here to my own devices. My father's retired. I've never seen an angel. I haven't heard voices rising out of stones or bushes. I send my little prayers out like bird feathers in a gale storm. No one ever said it would be easy, the understatement of several millennia. We plod along down here, doing what we hope is best, hoping what we do is right, while each breath, like a nail pounding through flesh, brings us closer to the end, to you. Okay. Two more poems. I'm not exactly sure who, why this poem is for Nick Bozanic. But he's a poet up in Interlochen, and I read think he had a poem called Instructions for Something. And I read it and I liked it and I thought, well, I should write a poem that's Instructions for Something. And so I kind of dedicated this poem to him. It's called Instructions for My Funeral. Nobody can wear black except me. I want to be dressed in a tuxedo, bow tie, patent leather shoes, an all-black wristwatch stopped. I want beer, wine, soda, coffee, and tea available free of charge, accompanied by several cheese and vegetable trays, barbecue chips, pretzels, Hershey kisses. The eulogy should be full of the bad jokes I was known for, several poems read, and a word of praise for the natural order of which I am merely a part. After a brief ceremony, no one is allowed to follow me to the graveyard. I want people to drive to the hall for dinner, drinks, a live band, and dancing. Outside, volleyball and horseshoes. At a table, my latest book should be sold at half price. I've pre-signed 50 copies in the closet for the occasion. No contribution to anything or anyone is requested. No grieving or crying will be tolerated. Life is too important to be bothered with despair of any kind. I want noise, music, laughter, the slapping of backs, jokes, hugs, stories. I want smiles on the faces of my children and relatives, on my wife and good friends. I want people touching each other. In this small moment of silence, I want anything but silence. I'll get enough of that where I'm going. And so will all of you. All right. There'll be some time for some questions afterwards, I know, and but I want to thank you for being a great audience. I know most of you in the audience. It's been like reading to friends, which is nice. But I want to end with a letter poem, and it's called Dear Heart. There's an epigram by Saul Bellow who said, "A man is only as good as what he loves." Dear heart, I have you to blame for making me the sap I am today. I'm the one guy in the Western Hemisphere who still cries every time he watches It's a Wonderful Life. Songs on the radio touch you and pull the heart's tear strings daily. When you well up in my throat, I have no choice. A stifled cry comes to my face as I fight to hold it in. You've given yourself away to my wife and children, and you act as if you have a mind of your own lodged in my chest, thinking up ways to make me bow down to you, to say love is the only thing worth praising. Maybe you're right. Maybe all of our words, all of our actions, our thoughts and ideas were meant to travel through the heart first before entering the world. You pound away at me like a second brain, subversive and graceful, wanting it all. And one day, if I'm lucky, I'll let you have it. Thank you very much. All right, any questions? The first poem I wrote was in 10th grade to Patty Bruss. I was a basketball star at. Hey, that's not funny. I was. I was a basketball star at Lakeshore High School, and of course, as the star, I had a cheerleader girlfriend, and of course, and then I got a blood clot, calcium deposit and torn ligaments on my right leg, and I had to wear a cast for 6 months. And as soon as I was no longer the basketball star, the cheerleader dropped me, and I couldn't do sports because I was in a cast. So I started filling up all these notebooks for that bitch, Patty Bruss. But I'm over it now. Yes. Well, that's a good question. I think I'd steal the material for both and all if it was good material. You know, if there was a story, I'd write a poem about it and a play about it and a story about it if I could. I love writing plays, and it's partly because other people are saying your words. You know, as a poet, basically, the only time you ever hear your words said is when you give a reading. I mean, rarely does anybody else. Even if somebody else reads your work, usually they don't read it out loud. Even, you know? So, and you never know that they're reading your work. So that was all in kind of, those are all reasons why I said, well, I'm going to write a play, because people will go to the theater. They won't go to a poetry reading, but they'll go to the theater. So there, I have an audience, you know, that would be good. It's just been, after reading a lot of plays and studying playwriting, you know, I just started to do it. I just started to try, and I'm still an apprentice, I think. I just have been lucky with getting three off Broadway so far, and they're only one act, so it's not like they're big things yet. But I guess I don't. It's a hard question to answer. I mean, sometimes when you're thinking in terms of situations and concepts, then you I at least work toward playwriting. I think of a situation. If I think of images, I'm thinking of poems much more. And you know, with a play, all you have is really dialogue. You can have people doing things, but it's been fun. I've enjoyed it, and I think it helps my poetry writing or my fiction writing. Just any writing helps, feeds off itself, the way I look at it. Even when I write articles and essays, I'm just playing with words, and the more I play with words, the more depth I'm going to be at it when I want to say something in a poem or in a play. Yes. Okay, I'll get an actor. Well, that's how I write my own stuff. I read it out loud. So when I'm writing it, I'm reciting it over and over out loud as well. Because there's the old phrase, you have to let your ear make some of the decisions with a poem, because it's an oral art. So I can't write a poem without saying it. Over and over. I don't know how many times, you know, I'll recite a poem out loud to myself. Yeah, as I'm driving to work, as I'm, you know, sitting in my office, or I'll just pick up the poems I'm working on and read them out loud. And they have to sound right. They can't just be the right images. They also have to have a sound quality. Yeah, well, it is, and I think as writers, we We do thrive off that. We like that part. It is personal, and you can, it's therapeutic. I mean, you can say things in poems that you couldn't say face to face, and you can make the world right in a poem. You know, you can do all those kinds of things. But at some point, I mean, and some people are just satisfied with that. They're satisfied with just writing and keeping it to themselves. But at some point, some people say, "Well, I want an audience. I don't want this just for myself. I want to communicate. I want to reach out and touch other people somehow." And then, you know, slightly different rules come into play when you want to communicate to somebody else. Because I can write something that I know what it means, but you people here might have no idea what it means. And so if I want to communicate to you, then I have to begin to adhere to different rules in writing, you know, using more concrete details, making things clearer, I think. Yes? Always. Yeah. Right. Poem, there doesn't have to, there can be conflict, but there doesn't have to be, right? But a play has to have conflict. Yeah. If there's no argument, there's no play, is what somebody once said. Of course, they say that about fiction, too. Robert Penn Warren says it. Put it bluntly, if there's no conflict, you have no story. I guess I would say the same, similar thing for playwriting. Well, thank you very much for coming. If there's any final question, then if not, thanks a lot. It's been a great audience.